This is the last week of the series that we called Highlight Reel, where we've been looking at some well-known people from the Old Testament who are known for like their heroic acts of faith and who are known for having like the powerful faith. And there's like even in Hebrews, there's like a whole chapter. It's like called like the Hall of Faith. And a lot of the people that we've been talking about, you'll find in there where it's talking about like their heroic acts of faith. And they're known as like these role models, but see, there's always more to the story. So has anyone ever seen like the AI created images of what it would look like if like people in history had social media? Has anyone seen that? Okay, I have a few of them for you, okay. And I'm like stuck in the chair so I don't knock things over, but I'm gonna have to get up and move around a little bit today. Okay, so let's see the first one. And it's kind of small, so I'm gonna read it for you. Who is this? Charlie Chapman. So this is so good, y'all. What was Charlie Chapman known for? Being funny. Silent movies. So look, his caption, it's just emojis. Like he didn't say anything. It's just emojis. Hashtag silent but golden. Yeah. Okay. So Charlie Chaplin. Still making us laugh. All right. What's the next one? All right. This is Marie Antoinette. And it says, when you just wanted to have cake and eat it too. Hashtag revolution vibes. Does everyone know this story? Does everyone get this? Let them eat cake. And then off with their head. Okay. So, George Washington, hashtag boat life. Catch me if you can, redcoats. King George, your move, hashtag crossing the Delaware. Yeah, I could totally see that happening. So the stoic face. All right, what's the next one? Okay, I'm gonna see how many people get this one, okay? Because Matt last night, I'm gonna tell on him, he was like, I don't get this one. Okay, it's Martin Luther. And it says, knock, knock. Got a minute for 95 small suggestions? Anyone get it? Yeah. Thank you, guys. Liam's like, me. He learned about it. Yeah. Yeah, you better get it. Right? So I thought that one, that's for the theology nerds in the room. All right. So I think, is that the last one? Oh, nope. We got one more. Abraham Lincoln just delivered a killer speech. Hope they remember it. Hashtag Gettysburg Address, 47 years. I think we could say, you know, safely that we remembered that one. So these are like, it's kind of silly, but it's kind of fun to think about, like some of these historical figures that are well known. Like, these are all characters who are kind of larger than life, right? These are all people who lived, who are known for like monumental things or big moments in history. But that's the highlight reel. Just like any social media post, it's just the highlight reel. So there's always more to the story than what you see through just a post or just a story in history. So it seems a little bit silly when you think of it like that, but that's how we see the people in the Bible when we read about these stories too. So, and if you get bored later, you can actually Google like AI images of like if people in the Bible had like took selfies. You guys will have to look those up on your own. So I was going to use some of those, but I was like, some of these could be borderline sacrilegious. So I'm going to let you guys look those up on your own. Okay. We're going to stick with, you know, beheadings and Martin Luther. So, all right. The people that we've been talking about, they seem larger than life. And they seem to have limitless faith and complete confidence in God in everything that they do. But we forget sometimes that they were just people. Like, they're just people who struggle with things like we struggle with things. And we can learn just as much by looking at their faults as we can by looking at their faith. It helps us to be able to relate to them, to recognize that even in their brokenness, God used them to accomplish great things too. So today we're going to talk about Jacob. So I'm going to tell on myself a little bit. The picture that I had in the graphic up here, we're actually supposed to talk about Gideon today, but on a last minute change of pace, we're going to pretend like the picture Gideon up here is actually Jacob, but we don't really know. That could have looked more like Jacob anyway, so I'm going to tell on myself just a little bit there. But I feel like Jacob is kind of important, and we don't talk about him all that much. See, he's kind of a big deal. And I think that in order to understand how big of a deal he really is, you have to understand his family tree. See, there's something really interesting about Jacob's position in the family tree of Abraham. Any guesses what that could be? I'll give you a hint. It has something to do with a sibling relationship. What's his birth order? He's the second born. He's the second born, yet he's known as the patriarch of Israel. See, in Hebrew culture, the birthright is passed down from the firstborn son in the family. The birthright's a double portion of the family inheritance, but also it's the responsibility to care for the mother and any unmarried sisters. But in this particular family tree, it meant much more than that. See, who was Jacob's grandpa up here? Abraham. And Abraham is no small person himself. See, granddad, Abraham, he was given a promise by God that he would become the father of a great nation that was more numerous than the stars in the sky. And because of this promise, any birthright that is passed down in Abraham's family tree includes being a carrier of this promise. So it wasn't just inheritance. It wasn't just the responsibility of caring for the mother and the unmarried daughters, the unmarried sisters. It included being a carrier of the covenant promise that God made to Abraham. Kind of a big deal. So the promise was secured with the birth of Isaac. So Abraham had a son named Isaac, and he was the promised child. But side note, Isaac also was not Abraham's firstborn. That's another story for another day. So Isaac had twins, Esau and Jacob. And this twin dynamic makes it a little bit more interesting. So we're going to jump into Genesis chapter 25, and we'll be in Genesis pretty much all day. So let's look at how this twin thing kind of works out here. Starting with verse 21, Isaac pleaded with the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was unable to have children. The Lord answered Isaac's prayer, and Rebekah became pregnant with twins. But the two children struggled with each other in her womb. Whew, that does not sound fun. So she went to the Lord about it. "Why is this happening to me?" she asked. And the Lord told her, "The sons in your womb will become two nations. From the very beginning, the two nations will be rivals. One nation will be stronger than the other, and your older son will serve your younger son." And when the time came to give birth, Rebekah discovered that she did indeed have twins. The first one was very red at birth and covered with thick hair like a fur coat. He sounds cute. So they named him Esau, which means hair. Then the other was born with his hand grasping Esau's heel, so they named him Jacob, which can be translated to heel and deceiver. The word Jacob looks very similar to both meanings. Isaac was 60 years old when the twins were born. Bless his heart. All right. So even in birth, Jacob was grasping to be first, but he didn't have to. See, while he was still in the womb, God promised that the older son would serve the younger son. That was a promise that was given to Rebekah, his mother, while he was still in the womb. All right, let's continue. The boys grew up, and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country. While Jacob was content to stay at home among the tents, Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau came in from the open country, famished. He said to Jacob, "Quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished." Side note, that's why he was also called Edom, which means red. Jacob replied, "First, sell me your birthright." "Look, I'm about to die," Esau said. "What good is the birthright to me?" But Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. He ate and drank and then got up and left. So Esau despised his birthright. Don't miss that last line there. Esau despised his birthright. Does anyone else picture like the Marvel comic version of like Thor and Loki when you're reading about Esau and Jacob? Like you've got like the big muscly strong one that's the older brother that gets, you know, like the inheritance and everything. And then you've got the sneaky, conniving trickster brother. See, the second born trickster is trying to secure his place above his brother in the family. You know, you gotta wonder, like, that can't settle too good for him. He was born moments after Jacob, or after Esau. Moments. Not days, not years, moments. He missed by moments being the rightful owner of the birthright. But see, Esau was hardly innocent here either. See, it clearly states that he showed contempt for his birthright. In other words, he did not respect or value his position if he was willing to trade it for a bowl of stew. That must have been some really good stew, or he must have been really hungry. Like, if he really valued and understood the weight of what his birthright and his family, the family of Abraham, really meant, then nothing could pry it from him. But without much argument, he willingly gave it away. See, the birthright was the legal claim for the family inheritance, but there was also a paternal blessing. It's part of Hebrew culture, a blessing that was passed from father to son near the end of the life of the father. See, the blessing was a verbal bestowal of divine favor and promise of leadership, abundance, and spiritual lineage. And it was often accompanied by a prophetic message. So although they were often intertwined, the two concepts, the birthright and the blessing, they're still very distinct things. They're not the same thing, which shows that they could sometimes go to different individuals. So even though now Jacob is the owner, by all legal sense, he is the owner of the family birthright, the blessing could still go to Esau. The blessing that carried that spiritual lineage could still go to Esau. So we read on in Genesis 27, verse 1. When Isaac was old and his eyes were so weak that he could no longer see, he called for Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son." "Here I am," he answered. Isaac said, "I am now an old man, and I don't know the day of my death. Now then, get your equipment, your quiver, and your bow, and go out to the open country and hunt some of the wild game for me. Prepare me the kind of tasty food I like, and bring it to me to eat, so that I may give you my blessing before I die." So Isaac knows that he's near death. So he calls his favorite son, Esau, and he says, "I want some stew." Like, there's a real thing with wild meat here. Like, the way to a man's heart, right? It's through his belly. So he says, "Go hunting. Make me a meal. I'm ready to give you my blessing." Now Rebekah was listening as Isaac spoke to his son Esau. When Esau left for the open country to hunt game and bring it back, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "Look, I overheard your father say to your brother Esau, 'Bring me some game and prepare me some tasty food to eat so that I may give you my blessing in the presence of the Lord before I die.' Now, my son, listen carefully and do what I tell you. Go out to the flock and bring me 2 choice young goats so I can prepare some tasty food for your father, just the way he likes it. Then take it to your father to eat so that he may give you his blessing before he dies." If you continue reading, you see how the plan worked. And with his mother's help, Jacob tricked Isaac into giving him the blessing that was intended for Esau. It's kind of clear here to see where Jacob got his like trickster ways from. So now Jacob's tricked his way into stealing both Esau's birthright and blessing. He thought that he had to scheme and manipulate to fulfill God's promise. See, God had given a promise, and so he is now orchestrating a way to make it happen. But see, we don't have to force what God's already promised. Because of the way that Jacob had stolen everything from his brother, Esau was understandably a little perturbed. So Jacob ran away. He ran away fearing that Esau was going to kill him. So if we read on in Genesis 28, verse 10, Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. When he reached a certain place, he stopped for the night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones there, he put it under his head and lay down to sleep. He had a dream in which he saw a stairway resting on the earth with its top reaching to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. There above it stood the Lord, and he said, "I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All the people on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you." When Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it." He was afraid and said, "How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven." Did that promise sound a little bit familiar? That should give you guys like little like tingle vibes of remembering back to the promise that God made to Abraham about his descendants and about how all the peoples and all the nations would be blessed through his family. See, God is renewing this covenant to Jacob. He's saying, "You are the patriarch of this family now. Through you, through your line, through your descendants, all the people of the world will be blessed. You are the chosen path in the family of Abraham." And Jacob, I think that this is so revealing. He says, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it." He was not aware of it. He was trying to scheme, to hide, to grovel, to get everything that he felt was owed to him. And he missed that God was already there. See, despite Jacob's tendency towards self-promotion, God still met him where he was at. When he was hiding, running away, sleeping with a stone for a pillow, God met him where he was at, and he renewed the promise to him. Jacob's story continues, and there's this constant theme throughout of him struggling and striving and tricking and grasping for what he wants in life. There's a story where he goes to Lebanon and he wants the right wife, but he gets the wrong wife. He actually gets tricked himself, gets a little taste of his own medicine. And then he gets the right wife. And then he ends up with two wives and then two servant wives. And then there's all kinds of strife and discontent between the wives over who's going to have the right kid and which of those kids is going to be the chosen descendant and which one should be right. And then the biggest flock, there's like this whole thing about him like choosing the choicest of the sheep and stuff so that his flock would grow beyond that of his father-in-law, tricking and scheming nonstop until he has the largest household to the point to where his brother-in-laws are just like, hey, we need to get rid of this guy because he's going to overtake everything that's ours. So he ends up basically getting kicked out of that land. There's no shortage to strife and division that's created by this pattern. But also his life flourished. He had 12 sons. He had flocks. He had land that belonged to him. His household grew to be enormous. He was blessed despite his strife, despite the way that he struggled to create it on his own. And see, his wives and his servant wives, they reflected this culture, this family atmosphere that he created and the way that they treated one another. There was constant discontentment. There was constant battling and comparison. And his children, they passed it on to his children who were constantly competing for position within his household. And in time, his manipulative ways, they caused him to be on the run again. But this time with all of his wives, with all of his children, his servants, and his livestock. And this was not any small number. See, in order to return to the land that God promised him, he had to face his past. He had to face his brother Esau. So when he gets close to the land and he knows that he's about to have to meet his brother, and justifiably, even though years has passed, he's not really sure what he's going to find. He's not really sure how his brother's going to greet him, you know, the one that he stole everything from. So he sends gifts, because that's what you do, right? You send gifts and a note and a messenger. And he literally just says, will you be friendly to me? Like, are you going to be nice to me? Are you going to try to kill me? And the messenger returned to Jacob. And when he came back, he didn't have so much a message from Esau for Jacob. But he informed him that Esau was coming to meet him with an army of 400 men. So at this point, Jacob's real scared. And rightfully so. So he goes through this whole thing, and I'm not going to read all of it, but it's a very interesting story. Read it. Read Genesis, y'all. It's so fun. There's great stories in it. Just when you get really frustrated because it doesn't seem like you're actually reading the Bible, still call Micah and she'll rant with you. Okay. But read the story. It's really interesting because there's even more scheming in the way that he positions people. He positions his wives and his children in order to meet. He positions his servants. He sends more gifts. He sends, like, I'm talking hundreds of goats and sheep and camels and cows and donkeys. And he separates them out strategically. He must have been a very, very smart man because he had a plan for everything. But he positioned them, and then he positioned his wives in different camps to where if one was overtaken, maybe some could escape. He was trying to control the narrative in every way that he possibly could. And then finally, he sends his family and everyone else across the river, and he stays in the camp by himself overnight. And this is where the story, like, really comes to a climax. Okay, so in Genesis 32, verse 22, that night, Jacob got up and took his two wives and his two female servants and his 11 sons and crossed the ford of the the river. After he had sent them across the stream, he sent over all of his possessions, so Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. I feel like that should be more than one sentence. Like, he was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. We're missing some information. Who's the man? Where'd he come from? Why'd they start wrestling? Like, I got questions. We don't have answers. So, I'm just going to keep asking questions. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, now get this, they've been wrestling all night. Now he's got a hip out of socket, and Jacob won't let go. He won't let go. He says, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And the man asked him, "What is your name?" Once again, like, before you start wrestling with someone, know their name. Like, that's just courtesy, right? But he said, "What is your name?" He said, "Jacob," he answered. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." The sun rose above him, and he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the tendon attached to the socket of the hip, because the socket of Jacob's hip was touched near the tendon. What a wild story. How, like, it's just like one of those stories that after you read it, you just got to sit there for a second and be like, did I read that right? Did I miss something? Like, was I daydreaming halfway through that? Like, there's so much more information I want here, but we don't have it. See, I've always been really intrigued by this story. And I've heard it presented as both a justification for arguing with God and relentlessly, like, telling him what you want from him, like, till the answer comes. You got to keep praying, like, just hold on and don't let go. And, like, this is what you need. And so you just tell God what you need and you hold on until you get it. I've also heard it presented as a warning story about how God will punish you if you question him. So which one is it? Like, it can't be both, right? But see, I think it reveals a lot about Jacob's insecurities. So you think about it. Everything that he had in his entire life had been promised to him by God while he was still in the womb. Before he was even born, God promised that he would be the one to lead the family. However, he had schemed, he had tricked his way into taking all of it for himself. Don't you think that he had to question whether or not he was actually living under God's promise, or if he was forcing it? Did he have all of that because he had forced it into being? And if so, was God about to allow Esau to take it all back? See, he couldn't run anymore. He had nowhere else to go. He had no more tricks. He had no more way of positioning anything or anyone. He was face to face with the reality of, if I only have what I have because I forced it into being, because I took it for myself, is God blessing it? Am I living under God's blessing? Or am I about to lose it all? See, was the blessing and the birthright he stole, was it valid in the eyes of God? See, he had to know. He could not let the sun rise without knowing if he was actually living under the blessing or if he had forced it. So he wrestled with God all night. And he wouldn't let go until he knew that God was with him. See, wrestling and struggling and striving and clawing his way up to the top. That was Jacob's pattern in life. He leaned on his own understanding, on his own ability, on his own strength, and his own cunning to be able to get where he was in life. And it took this moment of wrestling with God for him to finally realize that the only one who could give him the blessing that he so desperately needed was God. See, as a result of the wrestling match, God blessed Jacob and changed his name to Israel. And this new name signifies that he prevails with God. See, on a side note, isn't it, you know, his name was changed to Israel, and then it's known as the nation of Israel. And isn't it interesting that Israel means struggles with God? See, just like even the chosen people by name are called those who struggle with God. Like, there's no perfect people. We're all broken. We all struggle. See, his new name embodies his journey from self-reliance to relying on God. From hearing the promise and claiming it under his own strength and trusting God to fulfill the promise that he made in his timing. See, our striving, it wears us out. We can't do it. We can't make it all happen. But our surrender, it transforms us. When we finally let go. See, God changed Jacob's name from deceiver to striving with God. It's powerful. It changed his identity. It changed his focus. It prepared him to be the person that he was supposed to be, the one who would then bless his sons, who would become the 12 nations of Israel. His son Judah would become the patriarch of the family line that Jesus would be born through. See, in that limp that Jacob received from wrestling with God, it served as a constant reminder throughout his life that it's through surrender, not struggle, that God's blessing is given. See, we're going to do another song if the band wants to go ahead and come back up. It hit me this morning, and you know how sometimes God just like, there's like those little God winks in life? And, you know, like I told you earlier, when Matt put this set list together, we're planning on talking about Gideon. And it wasn't until worship this morning that I started seeing the pattern in the songs that we were singing. See, it's not, you know, it's not about how we fight. It's not about what we do. It's not about how we can do it. It's about who we're trusting to do it for us. You know, that first song, we sing, I'm fighting a battle that he's already won. See, the promise has already been made, and there's already been things put into motion that are preparing the way for God's promises to be fulfilled. Where we find strife is often in our own wrestling with trying to fix things ourselves, to secure the promise ourselves, to make things look right in our own eyes, in our own timing. But then the other song, Shalom. Shalom is peace. Shalom is wholeness. Shalom is more than just not having strife. It's about a wholeness of peace. And that can only be found through surrendering to God's plan, through trusting that his promise will be fulfilled in the way that we need it to be, in the way that he needs it to be for us. So we're going to do one last song. And during this song, I want you to, if you want to stand and worship and declare it, then do that. But if you need some time to take to just reflect, then take this time. Free from distractions, free from outside noise. But I want you to think of this question. What is it that you're striving for in your life that you really just need to surrender to God?